On the weekend panel this morning at 22 minutes to 9 o'clock, sports commentator and journalist Lavina Good. Kia ora, Lavina. In there somewhere, anyway. And Richard Harmon from the Politic website online. Are you there, Richard?
Morena, Jim. Yep, I'm here.
Morena.
I'm here.
Oh, and so is Lavina. Nice to talk to you, Lavina.
Good morning.
A highlight or lowlight from the past week from each of you to start, please. Richard.
I might steal Lavina's thunder here. The Black Caps overnight, England are ahead at the moment by 37 runs. They've got one wicket in hand. New Zealand should wrap this up pretty quickly today. A historic win and a series win against England. A good start to the week.
Sports news this morning from Richard Harmon. Yes, it is a good start to the week. And it looks like a done deal, doesn't it, with 2 days to go?
Yep. Definitely. That was that's a beauty for me as well, actually, Richard. That would have been my highlight, which I think we should all celebrate, which is great for the Black Caps, especially on the old turf in England. It's always tough to do. I have a low light, though, unfortunately, to start our session today. I had lunch with a good mate of mine through the week, and she's a nurse. And it was a really interesting insight just to have a chat with someone that wanted to talk about the fact that the government can come up with $13 billion, you know, really quickly to pay wage subsidies to some people that didn't really need it. And she feels as though on the end of her 12-hour shifts at the end of the day where she can't go home because there are people that are still sick, that the government should be able to come up perhaps with some more money and suitable conditions for her. And the thing that she said to me, Jim and Richard, is that she feels really sad that people are thinking nurses are only doing it for the money, that they want more money, and that's the way it will be portrayed. But she wants everyone to know it's not just about the money, it's about the conditions. And to sit down and have lunch with a nurse and to discuss the issues that she's facing was a real reality check for me.
Yeah, that's interesting. We'll return to that general topic because we're going to be, if we get to it, talking about how much tax the richest men in the world pay. All right, thank you, Lavina. And while we're still warming up, FoodSafe said this past week we should be washing our fruit and veggies before we eat them, I noticed, for between 1 and 2 minutes, especially herbs like parsley with complex leaves. 1 to 2 minutes for washing your food, Lavina, seems a long time.
That takes up a lot of time. There's one thing in life I've learned, you can't buy time. And to wash, I'm like, do I have to wash them for 1 to 2 minutes? I'm thinking about the fruit I put in the kids' lunches. Am I washing that, please? Yes, I know I am. Am I doing it for 1 to 2 minutes? I very much doubt it. I'm still trying to get my sons to come out of the toilet and nag them to wash their hands again because they only seem to do that when there's advertising of a pandemic. Is the only time they'll wash their hands. So I'm going to start with washing hands first, Jim, and get the boys to do that as often as possible. And then after that, I might contemplate the washing of some vegetables, which I need to do more, obviously, after speaking to you on the panel.
Obviously. Now, you'd think that the toilet would be a higher priority. Richard, how about you?
Well, it does seem odd, doesn't it? If you're going to boil them, why wash them?
Yes, I suppose that's the other exactly. argument, if you're going to boil carrots or broccoli. They may mean soaking, the nature of the 1 to 2 minutes, but it seemed a long time. All right, the serious topics. Too soon for the movie They Are Us about the Christchurch mosque attacks, Lavina.
Yeah, this is definitely a sensitive issue, I guess, for lots of people. I mean, it's a story that I guess needs to be told, but it needs to be told in a very sensitive way. I've noticed that the producer of the film has come out and said that there were huge challenges with trying to make the film. They've got a deep respect for the community, etc. But I guess for the issue of those involved in the attack, they would like to have been consulted more. I know not everyone was consulted, but a few were. But the focus being on the Prime Minister seems a little bit tasteless to me. That's something that I'm really not interested in watching this movie. And I think that they're focusing more on the issues at hand rather than the recovery situation. I think that they would realise that there is sensitivity there in the community about this just being a money-making venture. So I'm not surprised that there are thousands of people that have signed a petition that money is not given to this movie to go ahead.
Richard.
Well, interesting yesterday, wasn't it, that the Prime Minister disowned it, really, and said that she hadn't been consulted and said the story was not about her. I think she's adept at reading the public mood, and I suspect she's got this one right. Interesting also yesterday that they announced the establishment of a sort of advisory board that's supposed to advise the minister in charge of the response, which is Andrew Little, and that board is made up of members of the community. You would think it would be a fairly simple matter for the people involved in the movie and funding to just consult that board now if they haven't already got the cue from the Prime Minister.
Well, the film crews won't be welcome in Christchurch, says Leanne Dalzell. Does it sound to you, Richard, like its future is doubtful in the immediate? Well, certainly its immediate future.
You would think so. And also, you know, this is another typical example of what happens in the film industry. There is no funding at this stage. They're going to go to Cannes or some one of the film festivals to try and whip up some investment interest. So really, at the moment, it's simply an idea on paper. They're nowhere near being able to being ready to begin production. I doubt we'll ever see this movie.
16 to 9, some medical professionals, Lavina, are spreading misinformation about the COVID-19 vaccine with multiple complaints to the New Zealand Medical Council, say GPs. This is on Stuff. Simple question, if medical professionals are anti-vax, should they keep this to themselves?
Simple answer, yes. They should be censored, I reckon, by the Medical Council for touting non-evidence-based practice. So, yeah, they should keep it to themselves. I mean, the country's underway to try and stop this pandemic from, you know, taking us all down, and we all need to be unified. They can have an opinion, but keep it to themselves. It's really important that we're all on the same page here as we try and you know, get on top of things. It's really important, yeah.
It's always a tricky question, isn't it, Richard, given you're allowed your personal opinions. But what's your view?
Well, I think the Medical Council's the right place for this to be adjudicated. It's not a problem just in New Zealand. It's happening all around the world. The medical profession is not without its nutters.
With everything that you have both read, is there anything that would make you vaccine hesitant, Lavina?
No, and I've done a lot of research, being a journalist and also having lots of friends and colleagues that I know that work in the medical profession. No, I'm not hesitant. I've already had one vaccine. I'm preparing to have my second one next week. I'm not just doing that for myself. I'm doing that for everyone else. And that's the thing with vaccinations. You don't just vaccinate for yourself. You do it for the better of the community. Hence why we're not all dying at the moment of measles, mumps, rubella and whooping cough.
And Richard, I'm inferring you'd say the same thing.
Yeah, well, I live in the Capital Coast District Health Board area in Wellington, and even though I'm Category 3, I have heard nothing about a vaccination, so I guess for me the decision might be taken out of my hands. It seems unlikely at this stage that I'm going to get one in a hurry.
Yes, that's right. It's different strokes for different folks. 14 to 9, The Economist Intelligence Unit, not the Economic Intelligence Unit, has placed Auckland at the top of its list of the world's most livable cities. Lavina, I know you've lived here, but I'll go to Richard first. Richard, do you set much store by all these surveys of livability and happiness?
Well, the Auckland that I lived in, and I lived quite a long time ago, was livable. That was because it was possible to move around it. I now visit Auckland frequently. I've got an apartment there. It is impossible to move around it now, particularly if you want to go across the city, across those traditional sort of lines that lead into the now deserted central city. It's terrible. It's easier to get around any number of foreign cities than it is Auckland.
Lavina, you must come up here sometimes. Have you noticed the change in Auckland traffic?
I have, a massive change. When I lived in Auckland, I formed some beautiful friendships and had the world's best neighbours that will remain with me for life. And that's one highlight of me, of Auckland. I also love the cultural side of Auckland and the food and the restaurants. But the Auckland that I know now, that I visit, is behemothly big, massive, like the East Coast to the North Shore. it's so difficult to get around. If you don't have PayWave, you can't buy anything in Auckland. You can't get a four-bedroom rental for under $1,000. A flat white, which is made superbly, one of the best in the country, is now over $5. Windows are shut because of crime. People run red lights and people are perpetually wearing activewear because they're stuck in traffic all day. It takes 2 hours to get to the gym and 2 hours to get back. So I don't think Auckland would be on my list as number one. But for those that are living in Auckland and still loving it, I say congratulations to you. And if you want to head over to Tauranga, you'll find the greatest city in New Zealand.
Well, that's my next question. I suspect the Economist Intelligence Unit doesn't bother with Kirikiriroa, Otatahi, Tauranga and Otipoti. But if it did, where would you live if it weren't dependent on work and school and friends?
Yeah, I guess the work, school and friends do play a big part in it. That's something that I've really loved about the Bay of Plenty, is the fact that all the schools, be it private or public, are really, really decent schools, and it doesn't take a long time to get to them. But if it wasn't that case and I had a choice of where I would live anywhere in New Zealand, it would still be where I live today. And I guess it is because of the connections, Jim, and the friendships that I've made.
Richard, any thoughts on that?
Well, I grew up in Kirikiriroa, and it's always got a bit of a pull. But I've been going down to Dunedin, Otapoti, a bit lately, and it's kind of grown on me. It seems. I mean, at least you can drive around it.
Yeah, exactly.
And very
drive,
easily.
That's right.
I know Dunedin's always had its great charms. The Auckland fantasy is hoping that whatever you'd get for your house would get you into somewhere half decent down the line, Lavina, with money left over for living, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing, I think. There's not much money left over for living. And if you can afford to live in Auckland, it's a magnificent place to live. The restaurants are superb and culturally it's enlightening, but you need to have the money to afford it. And it's just becoming too expensive, hence why people are moving to Kirikiriroa or out of the Auckland Central just to be able to get houses that aren't as expensive and can live a decent lifestyle.
I'm glad you added some balance to that assessment of the magnificent life in Auckland. Now, Richard, National MPs have been quick to disagree with comments from education spokesman Paul Goldsmith that colonisation on balance has been good for Māori. And he's been criticising the New Zealand history curriculum with its focus on colonisation and more recently white privilege, which we've been talking about. And Judith Collins wasn't supportive either. But
in
after
my own ancestry, I don't think any of them, the Irish or the Welsh or even the English, when they were conquered by the Normans, actually ever came out very well out of it.
After a day or two, she seemed to become slightly more supportive. So, Richard, she's saying we at least had a treaty. We've paid in settlements for breaches of that treaty. Where do we both stand on colonisation? But, Richard, you first.
Well, there's no denying it. Colonisation would have been a disaster for any colonised people, because the very essence of colonisation, it means that your culture is going to be ripped away from you. Yes, it was possibly more mild in New Zealand than some places, but you can't say at the end of the day, if you were a Māori in 1839, that by the time you got to 1939, things had improved. Every statistic we know shows they haven't. So we've got to be conscious of that. Have we begun a process of ameliorating it? Yes, we have, and Collins is right to that extent. But it's a bit like saying we're cleaning up a huge mess. You can't say there was no mess, therefore, once it's all gone. Yes, there was a mess.
Lavina, what are your thoughts on this?
I'm really disappointed in Paul Goldsmith for coming out and saying colonisation on balance has been good for Māori. I'm really disappointed that we're at that stage where a National MP would actually announce that. I mean, the population has declined due to colonisation. Life expectancy has declined. Illnesses were introduced. I mean, colonisation's just had a really poor effect in terms of the consequences on Māori through land alienation, through economic impoverishment. It goes on and on and on and on. And I think we're at that stage that we need to educate our children the effects of colonisation. When I first came to New Zealand, Jim, 25 years ago, I was under the impression that the Treaty of Waitangi was signed and the Māori benefited from it and it was all rosy and we weren't educated any different. And my kids are hopefully learning something a little different in terms of as they progress through life, because the tikanga, which is a big heritage cultural side of things for Māori was taken away from them. So let's start thinking a little differently now. And it, you know, it had to come from a National MP because at the moment they're in disarray politically, so they need to be careful what they say to the media and in public.
So you're both saying, yes, there was a mess, so it's necessary to keep describing the mess and
the
history.
Yeah, keep describing curriculum. It and addressing it. Yeah, absolutely. Describing it and addressing it. Yeah, I think it's really important.
Pale, stale politicking, says the Māori Party. But Richard, he did write the biography of Te Hemera Tohia, so he obviously has an affinity. So is it still okay to have a discussion about what the curriculum will deliver?
Well, yeah, I think that's a discussion that's gathering pace a little bit. There's a very interesting report that's been put out by the Royal Society, and the CEO there is the new Governor-General, Cindy Kiro, which doesn't so much say that stuff should be taken out of the new curriculum, rather that there should be other material in it, and it focuses a little bit on issues like diversity, the other populations that have come to New Zealand, and also the history of New Zealand's interaction with the world more generally. So there's scope there to make change, and without throwing out the material about the treaty and about Māori.
7 minutes to nine. Lavina and Richard on the panel. I want to get to the Climate Change Commission's report, but Nick Smith's valedictory speech in Parliament apologising to his son Logan.
My hope is that we can squeeze out those last remnants of prejudice that the gay community still face.
I'm just really proud of him, and I'm really proud of him that he's manned up and he's acknowledged that he got it wrong in the past.
Which took the wind out of the sails, Richard, you again, if you don't mind, of the circumstances of his departure, which are still mysterious or not?
Well, they're not mysterious to me, because I'm absolutely convinced that Judith Collins told Nick Smith that there was to be a media story published about his the elite allegations of what happened in his office, the so-called bullying incident. And then she carefully set out that that media story was to be on Tuesday, a day that she had already declared off limits to the media because she was going to her son's graduation. Yeah, it was a stitch-up.
The bullying incident said to have been brief and both sides apologised. Just quickly, do you object, because we don't know what was said, so we're, you know, stabbing in the dark. But Lavina, do you object to robust language being used at work? If you say vigorously to someone, you're just not doing your job, and a nasty exchange ensues, how seriously would you view that if you heard it, if both people then apologised?
I don't know if I'd view it as bullying. I think if you vigorously compliment someone at work, then you might be able to vigorously get away with telling them that they're doing something wrong. So it's just an energetic way of saying, hey, you've done a great job, that's awesome, well done, or that was really poor and I'm disappointed and don't do it again. So I think it needs to be balanced. I think there's a fine line between using offensive language, bullying, and offending people in general at work. So, yeah, I think if the vigorous language is used positively as well as negatively, you can get away with it. But if it's just constant badgering and constant negativity, that's not a great work environment for you to be in. Culturally, it's not very healthy and you're not going to work very well.
The Climate Change Commission's final report, the Prime Minister said, I view the Commission's report as one of the most significant documents I'll receive in my time as Prime Minister. Richard, how did you receive it?
444 pages. It's fascinating.
That's a lot. That's
a lot.
It is significant. I think one really important thing about it is that it sets out a roadmap for 30 years. Things will change over those 30 years. It's not set in stone. It'll be modified, adjusted. There are clearly areas that are not going to stand up or are going to be pretty difficult to stand up. So it's the beginning of the big reality bath about climate change, I think.
Yeah, that's interesting you put the beginning of the big reality bath. Lavina, there will be an announcement later this morning on incentivising us into EVs. Do you see problems doing this quickly? Because we currently have 4.5 million cars. And there are a few problems, I think. But one is that we have 4.5 million cars on our roads using internal combustion.
Yeah, too many cars, too many people driving with just one person in the car, not enough public transport that's suitable for people needing to get to and from work. So I guess we need to be incentivized to make sure that these changes are made, because no one's going to go out and buy an electric car. Number one, they're really expensive because you know, Mr. Musk can't pay any tax, so we need to pay a fortune for all of our Teslas. That's really, really important. Number two, they're not that aesthetically pleasing at the moment, and we need to have services here where you can use an e-car and I can get to Auckland and back for work without having to charge it. So times will change. I agree with Richard. I mean, God bless you, Richard, for reading the 444 pages. I must admit I didn't get through all of those. But I do appreciate the fact that there is a plan that we need to stick to, and if not, we won't be living in a great place in the future. And it's not fair to leave it up to the kids. So many people say, oh, the kids, leave it to the children. They'll be fine. They're smart. They'll be fine. We have to grapple it now, and we have to make those changes now. So if we're incentivized to do it, that's okay. But it would be great to see not so many single driving vehicles out on the road all the time. People don't carpool anymore. Mm. People are hardly carpooling. They need to carpool.
Yeah, that's true. The word carpool's disappeared from the vocabulary. I think he stopped at page 410. I'm reliably in.
You can read it after this, Richard.
The rabbits you can skip.
What will happen, Richard, what will happen now down the line if there's a fee bait on cars to get people out of them, which has been successfully used in Europe? That would also stir the pot too.
It would. But look, the big practical problem with cars that faces New Zealand is that we drive on the right-hand side of the road. And that means that because we buy second-hand cars, really the only place we can get them from is Japan. And the big problem there is Japan is not going to full EV cars. It's going to hybrids. And this was all pointed out in a very interesting statement, somewhat self-serving, from Toyota this week. So there's a lot of work to be done on the car thing. And at the end of the day, the people that Avina's talking about who can't get public transport tend to be the lower income people who live in those Auckland suburbs who can't get to work without a car. How are we going to accommodate them? There's going to have to be subsidies and help, and that is if we can find the cars.
If we can find the cars. Okay, just before we go, because the news is upon us, Lavina Good, Richard Harman have been on the panel. ProPublica Online says it's seen the tax returns of some of the world's richest people, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, Warren Buffett. Mr. Bezos paid no tax in 2007 and 2011, according to them, and Elon nothing in 2018. And the richest 25 Americans pay 15%, 15.8% of gross income. What do you think of that, just really quickly before we go, Lavina?
I'll start and then I'll let Richard finish. I'm appalled by that. It's disgusting. And how sad that we live in a world where the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. You shouldn't be ashamed. They should be ashamed and they should be paying taxes and not paying any taxes. I'm appalled by it. It's disgusting.
Richard, just very quickly.
I think this is the kind of thing that the G7 should certainly talk about. And can we put capital gains tax back on the agenda, please?
Brilliant. Thank you both.